And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Something's coming, but it's not clear what that is. Suddenly, America finds itself in the midst of a series of major projects that affect the lives of all of our people, some directly. And in the midst of all that, we're literally running short on energy. Something's coming when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Good to have you here. You know, yesterday morning I woke up, turned on my computer to find out that one of its three hard drives had crashed. 100 gigs of data were no longer available. Now that's a shocker on the day that I put this show together. Lucky for me, the drive that crashed did not have my C drive on it, so my computer still functioned. I just couldn't get to lots of stuff. I took an inventory and found that all my image files, all my music and video files, all of my recordings were gone. Could I survive? Well, I had a backup, but it had been a while since I did the backup. Plus, there's all the work to try to make it happen. It was a real loss. And in those early morning hours, it suddenly occurred to me that what I had lost had been similarly lost by hundreds of thousands of people along the Gulf Coast. Thousands of computers were lost, and all the contents gone. We see the images of the devastation, the ruined homes and cars, the businesses gone. I read of a library in Louisiana that reported that what remained was the slab. I tried to upgrade the concept of my loss to embrace the magnitude of the Gulf Coast victims. Today, we try to get a sense of what appears to be an unending loss of control in our lives. I'm going to talk about a need for something new in our society. In segment two, we've all heard of recycling. It's a great way to conserve our resources. When you look at the Gulf States and the massive piles of broken homes and businesses and realize that all of that will have to be reconstructed, we talk with a man who is running a great business recycling construction materials. It's a very timely look at a most practical business that should find offshoots throughout the entire rebuilding zones. And then, in segment three, this last weekend I was in the nation's capital and attended the Green Festival and had the chance to talk with someone who is helping us bring greater value to our travels and vacations. You've heard of ecotourism. We'll learn what it's all about and how you can make the most of these incredible adventures. So we've got a great show coming up, and we'll get things up and running following today's news. And so now, the news. The good news is there are no storms lurking off in the Atlantic Ocean right now, so there should be a lull in the hurricane season, which is officially over in November. The unfortunate news is that 4 days after Rita hit west of New Orleans along the East Texas-Louisiana border, aid in the form of federal relief remains about as scarce as an ice-cold glass of water. 40,000 Texans, 250,000 Louisianans, and 20,000 Mississippi residents are still without electricity, which, for anyone who has spent any time in that area, well knows is hot, humid, and now horrific. As with Katrina, federal emergency management remains, well, complicated by red tape, to say the least. Following a hearing of former FEMA head Michael Brown on Tuesday, many were left with the obvious conclusion that Brown was not only not the man for the job, but perhaps verging on criminally incompetent. We will have more on this later in the broadcast. Thousands of experts are bumping into one another trying to determine what to do to get the Gulf area fixed, and it's a task of unfathomable complexity. Concerns that the storm's damage to oil platforms and refineries would result in immediate price surges at the gasoline pumps have not as yet been realized. 16 Gulf refineries remain closed as a result of Rita. Oil and gasoline production is returning, which is a welcome relief to local Gulf Coast residents who have had to endure 3 to 4 hour long waits in lines to refuel at gas stations. President Bush announced Tuesday, a month after Katrina, that he will open up the strategic oil reserves to keep oil prices stable and encourage Americans, finally, to drive less to conserve energy. Every bit does help. Thank you, Mr. President. Meanwhile, amazingly, the major automakers are ramping up a plea for President Bush to take more aggressive action to cut U.S. dependence on petroleum, the Wall Street Journal reported on Monday. Ford Chairman and Chief Executive William Clay Ford Jr. sent a letter to President Bush asking that an energy summit be held involving the automakers, suppliers, fuel providers, consumers, and government officials with an eye to finding solutions for alternative fuel resources, and included a statement that the recently signed $17 billion national energy bill was, quote, only the beginning. Separately, Jim Press, the head of Toyota's U.S. operations, said he planned to go to Washington next month to lobby lawmakers to make energy independence an issue in the election campaign of 2008. Press is quoted as saying, "We recognize the responsibility we have to come up with a solution to this economic problem. As an industry, we should leave our individual companies' bags outside the door to work together on this issue." General Motors' top Washington spokesman, Chris Preuss, added, "We believe the U.S. needs to begin aggressive policy moves away from petroleum toward hydrogen. We should diversify our energy stocks away from foreign sources." The three key auto executives sound like future advocates for energy independence. Here on the Wild Side News, we will keep you posted. And a final story in three parts to show how complex these issues truly are as we move towards the globalization of greed rather than the globalization of cooperation. Tigers, Part 1. The head of India's new task force fighting to save the nation's dwindling population of tigers said last Friday that the big cats were on the verge of extinction because of rampant poaching for their body parts. According to experts, 40,000 tigers existed in India a century ago. The current population is estimated to be as low as 2,000 animals. Tigers, Part 2. China this last week announced that it is considering reopening of the Chinese business in tiger parts. China, which banned trade in all tigers and tiger parts in 1993, is now contemplating reopening the business based on farm-bred captive animals. Unfortunately, such will send out tiger part wish lists to poachers around the world, which helps to keep a healthy illegal wildlife trade worth $8 billion per year. According to the Wildlife Conservation Society, illegal sales of pelts of tigers and other rare cats have been surging in Tibetan regions of western China. And we all thought the Tibetans were so spiritual and hip. Chinese state media reports that native South China tigers, among the rarest of the world's five remaining tiger subspecies, were on the verge of extinction in the wild, with less than 30 left alive. The Siberian tiger of northern China and southern Russia is believed now to number less than a few hundred. Tigers, Part 3. The tiger population at a reserve in central India has increased after Maoist rebels who control most of the forest kept poachers away. The Maoists, who operate out of jungle bases in 9 states, say they are fighting for the rights of poor peasants and landless laborers. They have killed politicians and policemen in this 40-year-old revolt. But, according to Warden N.K. Bhagat, the tigers are totally safe. We have had no reports of poaching. And that's the news. This last story is a perfect introduction to the analysis I will give to finish up this first segment. As our nation struggles to regain its equilibrium after being broadsided by two of the nation's largest natural disasters, the effort is compounded by major challenges. Yes, the good old price of a barrel of oil and the price of a gallon of gas continue to wear down our chances of economic recovery. This, while a reckless gamble in Iraq forges global hatred for America, and the deficit becomes our economic mushroom cloud looming overhead as the threat of a global pandemic of bird flu is poised to send new levels of panic and fear around the world. We look back on the last 4 weeks and realize that our government is admittedly and ashamedly unable to respond to literal life and death issues in our own cities, towns, and countrysides. Is this a gloomy picture? You bet. And quite literally, the future of life, of our tigers and frogs, insects, fish, friends, and even our enemies, is at best out of control. America, as we have known it, may truly be at a crossroads. And from my vantage point, it has become obvious that we may simply be reaching a point of what appears to be a spontaneous anarchy, brought about directly from a system that has at its very center an out-of-control political fight to the death that is taking all of us who work within this struggle down with them. Shame on our politicians. Shame on those who support the war of wills. Shame on the press that ignores the real people's will. I am prepared to say that the system is broken. The power entrusted to the two parties is leaving us vanquished, exhausted, set adrift in the refuse of what once was a working democracy. I look at the hurricane recovery efforts and realize that the problem is much bigger than the federal government can possibly manage, with all of its forms and regulations and fears and the ever-present wealth that comes from the inside deals. I look to the southern communities that lie in shambles, still trying to develop a sense that there is the ability in the short term to provide food, shelter, water, health care, education, jobs, re-education, relocation, to maintain the human spirit of those who have lost absolutely everything, including their homes, possessions, communities, friends, mothers, daughters, children, fathers, and brothers. And that is just the first stabilizing stage. Then comes the massive effort to rebuild the complex working systems of our own human communities that have taken hundreds of years to develop, in place, comprised of streets, lined with homes, that light with electricity, that is provided as people pay their monthly bills with checks, checks and credit cards, used to buy shoes and tickets to ball games, fresh chickens and gambling money, that allows musicians to sing for tips on the streets, and children to stay home sick from school, and passion after a few late-night drinks with a new friend, as a knob turns up the volume on an old Fender amp, and a cop lets the speeder go because he's tired. It's our world, it's our community, and it's broken, and they're trying to fix it. Meanwhile, the future of the American Gulf is secured by Halliburton within 48 hours of the hit, with secret no-bid deals, with the overhead and overtime and overcharging that comes with the inside deal while people plead for water. Will America be rebuilt by its people, or will its people be reshuffled to meet the management needs of the few who believe they know best what we all should do with their guidance? My gut and my soul cry out now more than ever that we take and maintain the dream that was America based on self and self-sufficiency, independence and independence of mind, equal opportunity to restructure our towns and homes and backyards and lives with our own hands and backs, sweat and small loans, control from our homes and towns, and reassembling our lives in a neighborly fashion. We witnessed the results of believing that help was on the way, that saving lives was the number one mission. People are so capable. Our cumulative intelligence, spirit, and will united supersede all the centralized power players who hold the reins of power. Move, within your own communities, within your own towns, looking one another straight in the eyes and making deals with handshakes and scraps of paper. Let the honor of honorable men and women lead us onward and upward to renew this republic. Left, right. It was telling to witness FEMA's now-deposed chief, Michael Brown, as he blamed the people for his failures. Left, right, wrong. Something is terribly wrong. Change is happening. The game board just got tipped, and the players have fallen. Something's coming, and we do not know what it is. And it needs to be so much different than it has been. Something's coming. Keep your eyes open. Move towards all the things we know are right for us now. It will not be easy. That is the magic matrix of change. Something's coming, and it is us, or it's them. It's time to decide, so that this never happens again. When we return, we give you simple, powerful ways to get the rebuilding process started when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
And so, the rebuilding begins. But first comes the cleanup. What are they going to do with the hundreds of thousands of homes destroyed in the rage of the hurricanes? There is a great business opportunity that turns the cleanup and the rebuilding into a sustainable, profitable, appropriate effort. It's coming up for you when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. I have been staggered by the images of the wreckage, of the homes torn into their parts, the rafters and roofs and windows and doors heaped into massive opportunities to do the right thing. Here's where a lot of progress can begin. And it's a great business opportunity for people all across America.
Recently, the images from the results of the Katrina and now Rita have shocked me when I see piles and piles and piles and piles of lumber. And homes and doors and windows and everything just as debris, supposedly from the storm. And it bothers me to think that all of that could be salvaged, portions of that could be salvaged and used, as opposed to being bulldozed into big piles and then just we have no idea what. I'm talking with a guy who actually understands a lot of this. That's Jim Shulman, who's with a. Why don't you talk about your company first of all?
Sure, I'm with Community Forklift, a surplus and salvage building materials store located in suburban Washington, D.C. We're a brand new startup, but we're modeled after stores like The Loading Dock and many others around the country that have been around for a while, operating on the principle that one person's trash is another person's treasure. And so what we do is take donations of building materials, things that are stored in people's attics or basements that they're never really going to use, but they can't bear to throw away, and we resell them very affordably at half the price of Home Depot to people who can use them. And this is renovation contractors, homeowners, facility managers, cabinet making companies, you name it. So the opportunity is there, certainly, with storm debris to take that sow's ear and turn it into a silk purse. The challenge is that when there's a storm, people want to recover quickly. And so it takes some planning and forethought not to just do the wrong thing and bulldoze and burn. But apparently FEMA has taken an interest in this relatively recently, and they're getting some advice from members of the Used Building Materials Association, which is now called the Building Materials Recovery Coalition, in order to be able to do this.
One of the points that you make is the fact that it is possible, because there is going to be an abundance of materials conceivably available if this were actually utilized, and that is to salvage this and then provide a place for people to buy it. There could be a lot of this available, and it is a way for people to actually set up a shop and start to market some of this and sell it.
Yep. People have established these ReStores, which is the Habitat for Humanity moniker for this type of facility, as well as facilities like ours. They're for-profits, they're non-profits, in general selling surplus and salvaged building materials all over the country. And some of them have even started in the back end of a cafe. One of the limiting factors has been growth. These businesses have shown to double in size every year consecutively for 5 years. And so the bane of a lot of the startups has been not having enough warehouse space. And so we made a point to find a 40,000 square foot warehouse from the get-go and open up and not have to worry about having to move for a few years at least. And so that's something I would recommend to anybody who's living in a community that doesn't have a surplus and salvage building materials store, and you want to get into this business, find an empty barn or a cheap government building that's underutilized. We know for a fact that people in Baltimore, for instance, the loading dock was actually given their building by the Baltimore, and that's allowed them to be very profitable for 22 or 3 years running.
So where do you get your materials from?
About 50% of the materials we have in our inventory right now come from deconstruction projects. These are actually situations where homeowners have hired, instead of a demolition company, they've hired a deconstruction company to hand dismantle their homes. It takes a little bit longer, but if you include the tax deduction that people can get by donating the materials to a store like ours, it actually can cost less than hiring somebody to bulldoze their house and make a real mess. One of the nice things about a deconstruction site is they're incredibly clean. We're talking, you couldn't believe that a building had been taken down at some of these sites. And so they're naturally just healthier for people. A lot of the debris and dust is not in the air for us to breathe, including all that lead paint and PCBs and mercury that ordinarily are not removed from buildings in many jurisdictions before they get demolished.
What kind of stuff are you looking for? What doesn't work for you?
Well, at our store, we've made a decision not to handle furnishings, furniture. The Washington area is awash in office furniture. But other stores around the country have done very well with furniture. It's just our choice to stay away from that. We do accept donations of appliances if they're in working order and are relatively new, young appliances, so that they're relatively efficient, because we don't want being purveyors of a green business, we wouldn't feel right about pushing inefficient appliances on people.
Well, for example, doors, windows, wood,
yes,
paneling, and then some stuff I'm curious about. For example, tin roofing and stuff. Can you recycle stuff like that? What kind of, in the building materials realms, what works and what doesn't
work?
Well,
anything that cannot be reused can and should be recycled. That's not our business per se, although we do have recycling bins at our facility. But in general, we handle any materials that have some life left in them for reuse. And in the long run, we really want to get into remanufacturing, because actually that's where a lot of hidden capital is for communities to be able to create jobs. Eventually, we look to find those materials that we have trouble selling, those products that maybe don't have much resale value, and figure out ways to remanufacture them into something that has higher value. And the best example of this I've come across is the Winnipeg ReStore in Manitoba, Canada, takes window glass from single-pane windows and frosts it and inlays it into lacquered boards and sells them very expensively as chessboards.
Yeah. Actually, a fun aspect of this, too, is if people are in sort of historical zones, some of those doors and other pieces actually have terrific value from almost as antiques.
Oh, yes.
The five panel and the six panel and the odd doors and things like that.
Right. Many restores and surplus and salvage places focus on what you're calling architectural artifacts. Our focus is actually not in that direction. Our mission is to provide staple building materials, lumber, bricks, doors, windows, very affordably for people who may not be able to afford a new door at all. Included in our inventory, just because we're in a historic city of Washington, D.C., we have quite a few items that would satisfy the Historic Preservation Review Board's requirements.
Well, it's interesting because you get a little book and you find out about this stuff, and the next thing you know, you got a doorknob that's worth $150, you know, as opposed to $2.
We had an auction at our facility a few weeks ago. It was an auction of items removed from the Pentagon, part of the reconstruction of Wedge 3 of the Pentagon. And some community forklift, our store, inherited some of the doors and other items that were left over that didn't sell at the auction. And so if anybody who hears this is interested and wants to come and buy a really, really solid, large, beautiful door from the Pentagon, some of which have handicap hardware and all kinds of interesting combination locks, come check us out.
Now, do you have a website?
Yes, it's very simple. It's www.communityforklift.com.
Would you invite inquiries from people who may be interested in starting their own business? Do you have time to talk with a few people?
Absolutely. People could call Jim Shulman, that's me, at 301-985-5180.
Fabulous. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sydney.
And when it's time to take a break from all the hard work and maybe take a little vacation, ecotourism just may be more important now than ever before. When we return, you'll learn all about it here on your Voice of the Earth, the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith. Ecotourism is fast becoming one of the most desirable ways to take a break. Take an adventure in cross-cultural communication, purposeful travel, self-education, and even saving the planet when we return. We explore it all here on the Wildside News. This past weekend, I was off to Washington, D.C., where I walked my talk, and then talked and walked amongst some wonderful, earth-friendly, eco-literate folks at the Green Festival held at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. I met my audience, and they are an impressive bunch. There were hundreds of booths purveying foods, furnishings, fashions, and friendly souls exploring the many realms of a sustainable world. Well, that world is filled with wonder and opportunities, particularly to those who venture out through ecotourism.
We keep hoping that we can manage to find a way to see this beautiful planet and all of the most amazing mysteries and wonders. And I'm talking with someone who promotes this from A to Z, who's Martha Honey, who's with the International Ecotourism Society. Let's have you talk about that first.
The International Ecotourism Society, or TIES, T-I-E-S, is the oldest and largest ecotourism association in the world. We were founded in 1990, We have members in about 90 countries around the world, and we also serve as a kind of umbrella organization for some 30 to 40 nationally based or regionally based ecotourism associations. Our purpose, we're a non-governmental organization, an NGO, and our purpose is to help promote good practices both within the industry and among travelers.
A lot of people have traveled before, and really the world is changing a lot. What response are you getting from people who are out there revisiting the world these days?
Well, you know, I think that what we've seen is that during the 1990s, this concept of ecotourism, which actually has its origins back in the late 70s, in part growing out of the growing worldwide environmental movement. But by the 1990s, ecotourism had become the fastest growing sector of the tourism industry. Now, it was starting very small, but it was growing very fast, somewhere between 20 and 34% a year, whereas overall tourism was growing at 9% a year. And it remains, it has, even though since 2000, there's been all sorts of things that have buffeted the tourism industry, from natural disasters like the hurricane in Katrina and the tsunami in Asia, to terrorism and the war on terrorism and an economic recession. For all those reasons, tourism has taken a hit, but what we have seen is that ecotourism has remained strong. And we've been doing a lot of analysis and looking at surveys and so on, and the demand for what we could call ecotourism or responsible travel is strong among tourists. A majority of people, somewhere around 80 to 90% in the U.S., in Europe, and in Australia, say that they want to travel in ways that do not damage the environment. Close to equal numbers to that say that they want to learn something when they travel about the culture where they're visiting, about the people they're visiting, and so on. So these are very good numbers. What we also find, though, on the sort of downside, is that very few people do much about it. It's a broad desire, but it's not an activist community. And so one of the missions of TIES, of the Ecotourism Society, is to try to give people the tools so that they can be more active when they travel, that they can really know where to go, so that they can find the good companies to go with, so that they can personally travel in ways that are more responsible and so on, that they can really practice what their beliefs are without too much trouble. And there are a growing number, our website and a growing number of other websites, that are really helping travelers to do that, as well as the guidebooks are beginning to reflect, you know, a number of the sections on ecotourism, on sustainable tourism, and so on. And a lot of countries are beginning to sort of market themselves as being environmentally responsible, Costa Rica being one of the leading examples of that. Even here in the U.S., we're beginning to see a growth of ecotourism. We just had a major conference. It was the first ever conference looking at ecotourism in the U.S., and with over 300 people came to Bar Harbor, Maine, in mid-September to discuss what's going on here in this country. And there are several statewide ecotourism associations, Hawaii, Alaska, West Virginia, and a couple of others, and many more that are in the works. So I think that it's becoming easier to find good ecotourism places, but it does take a little bit of work. And what we're saying is that we need to be as responsible when we travel as we are when we pick a school for our kids or buy a home or purchase our coffee in the morning or whatever. We have to build that kind of ethic of research and sort of activism into our travel as well.
Well, let's say that I wasn't that familiar. I'd heard the term. It sounds interesting.
Right.
Something that makes a lot of sense. But then I say, but what does it really mean? How can coming to you, for example, help that person better define what it is that they'd like to accomplish?
Okay, well, let me tell you what to us it means. I think there are three components to it that are most important. It is that a person's travel, you should travel in ways that are light on the land and provide tangible benefits to conservation. So for very specific things like going to national parks and paying the entrance fees, trying to, if there's projects that are supporting local conservation groups where you're traveling, trying to make a contribution to those kinds of activities. The second tenet of ecotourism is that it should be respectful of local cultures and, again, provide tangible benefits to local communities. So make sure that you're buying locally, that the lodge or the hotel where you're staying is locally owned. You're very consciously trying to put money into the local economy, not supporting those internationally owned hotels that where most of the money goes out. It's called leakage. It goes out of the host country. So you travel in ways that put money into the local economy. And if there are local projects, projects that your hotel or your tour operator is supporting, try to support those local NGOs or whatever. And then the third tenet is that you should travel in ways that are, of course, enjoyable, but also educational, that you travel with a view to learning something when you travel. Vacations are much more these days than just simply going and lying on a beach in Cancun. And what we find is that this is really sort of good news, because people come back from these vacations saying, "Wow, why didn't I do that before? I learned so much. It was enjoyable. I felt good about what I was doing. This is the way I want to travel from now on." So it really is just taking some steps before you travel, thinking about things as you travel. We call it your travel choice makes a difference. And we have a section on our website, www.ecotourism.org, called Travel Choice. And on that, we have some of the most responsible companies around the world, tour operators, lodges, and so on. And we also have tips for what you should do when you travel.
You know, one of the fun things about this as well, and all the points, well, you know what you're talking about. This is great. But it's also the fact that what we're really doing here to a large degree is beginning to globalize this sustainable vision.
That's right.
And it's one thing to go and see, but it's also another thing to actually do something, because we really do have to get our hands and our bodies out there to make a difference. This is really this is a hands-on experience. I would guess, and you can respond to this, but I get my goosebumps, okay? But a lot of people who go on these events come back really charged up with a new sense of mission and realize that they can actually do something.
Right. That's absolutely right. And we call this, one of the ways you can do it is through something that we call Traveler's Philanthropy. This is a growing movement by the most responsible tourism companies to identify and then support projects in their host communities. This can be an AIDS orphanage, as Mikado Safaris is doing in Kenya. It can be schools and hospitals, as CC Africa is doing in South Africa. It can be community center, as a number of places, or schools, as a number of places, hotels in Costa Rica are doing, lodges in Costa Rica are doing. There's a whole variety of things that can go on. Lindblad Expeditions is supporting the Charles Darwin Research Center and the National Parks and the Galapagos. A whole variety of projects. And what this means is that both on your trip, you can make a donation to help support these projects. And when you come back, you can continue to be involved in these projects so that you can both, in a way, relive your vacation, but also stay connected with the places that you've traveled. So we really see this whole growth of what we call Traveler's Philanthropy. We had a major conference on this at Stanford University in 2004. We see this as a growing movement for corporate social responsibility within the tourism industry, and it's also a way that travelers can, again, think more profoundly about the kind of traveling they're doing and the responsibility that they have as a traveler.
I'm not going to ask you what you think is your favorite one, because I bet everybody hits you with that. And quite honestly, the best thing to do is for people to go to the website and just kind of become familiar. Why don't you repeat the website?
Yes, the website is www.ecotourism.org. And we're also a membership organization, and there's membership from travelers, just come people who are interested in ecotourism, on up to businesses and NGOs and so on. So, we also welcome new members and would love for people to check out the website.
Fun thing could be family ecotours. Is that happening?
Yes, it is. And we have several members of TIES, of the Ecotourism Society, specialize in family tours. A number of them do. Some of them do only family tours, and some of them run family tours and organize them. And absolutely, I mean, we learn through it. Now that my kids are grown, I can say this, having seen it through the different stages, but we learn through the eyes of our kids. And again and again and again, we hear that it's, they took the kids on a vacation and they learned because the kids were interested in recycling, the kids were interested in the local community, the kids wanted to go visit that school and so on. And so kids are helping the parents become better travelers. And it's a great way to travel. We're seeing three generations also now traveling, grandparents, parents, and kids going. And there are all sorts of wonderful places. That's one of the nice things, that ecotourism is a way to provide intergenerational travel in a way that in the past we sort of, we didn't. It was just one generation. You sent the kids to camp, the parents went off, and the grandparents went off all separately. And now we're really seeing families traveling together.
You have a book out.
I've got a couple of books, but the one that is sort of most popular is called Ecotourism and Sustainable Development, Who Owns Paradise? And that looks at seven destinations around the world and sort of looks at their ecotourism policies, how strong it is, how and so on, and tries to put it in context. I'm doing a new edition of that, which I hope will be out next year. But, and then I have another book on certification called Ecotourism and Certification, because this is a growing movement within the ecotourism and sustainable tourism field, something that I feel is extremely important because it's a way of countering what we call greenwashing. It's a way of separating the wheat from the chaff so that you really know who are the genuine companies, because they've passed muster in a whole variety of environmental, social, and economic criteria.
We do have to be careful that people aren't just calling it ecotourism and
absolutely.
Works absolutely in the opposite direction.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that I learned in doing this first book, looking at ecotourism in seven different destinations, was that there's an awful lot of really spectacular projects out there. I mean, people really doing tourism with strong ethical values and in responsible ways. There's also a lot of scams and shams out there. And I sort of divided the ecotourism world into three sectors. The genuine ecotourism businesses, what I call ecotourism light, those places that, for instance, maybe give you just the opportunity not to wash your sheets and towels every day, but are doing nothing else. And then those just, you know, flat-out greenwashing scams that are only using green language and there's nothing green about them. And there's a bunch of those too. So you have to, you know, you have to be a smart traveler and you have to get beyond the labels, because there are an awful lot of labels and marketing out there, and really look behind to see, you know, what are the practices of the companies that you're using.
One of the things that I'm a little concerned about, and I hate to admit this, and that is loving something to death. To what degree is, can this backfire on us?
Absolutely. And good ecotourism sets limits. It looks at how many people can go, should go, to a place to keep it the way it is, to not ruin it. And it also can say, good ecotourism should say, in some cases, nobody should go here. It's extremely important that if the area is owned by or there are indigenous people there, that they make the decision as to whether or not there is tourism in that area, and then what kind of tourism. And we have to set limits. We're seeing places that are being loved to death with too many tourists, uncontrolled tourism, and pretty soon it's mass tourism, and then it's ruined. So absolutely, ecotourism is also about limits.
We're talking with Martha Honey, who's added her voice to the Wild Side News. Give your website again and the name of your organization.
The International Ecotourism Society, TIES, and the website is www.ecotourism.org.
Thanks for being on the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me.
As has been stated so many ways for thousands of years, out of the chaos comes the opportunity. I encourage each of you to take control of your own future in new ways and help those who now must adapt to forge this nation and this world into one that is meant for us all, the living wonder of life on earth. So until we meet again, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until next time, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth will ring around the world in the global network of peace and wonder here on the Wild Side News.